30 years, the film has held up incredibly well. It's definitely my favourite Australian film. What do you think has kept it so enduring after all these years?
Well, I think it's a universal coming-of-age story. Everyone identifies with, you know, that moment in childhood when you become an adult, or the beginnings of an adult. It evokes a kind of a comfortable, old-fashioned country lifestyle of the 50s and into the 60s, I suppose, in Australia, but just gives it BMX bikes, it celebrates Aboriginal mythology in a respectful way, so it has a number of ingredients, I think, that don't generally all occur in a kid's picture, and I think there are things that parents and children can talk about after seeing it. So I hoped it would be a perennial, and I'm glad it is.
So I know you have discussed before on Mark Hartley's documentary, you briefly discussed how you got involved with Frog Dreaming. Just to put some context into this discussion, can you just briefly talk about how you became involved with the film?
Well, I had just finished shooting an episode of 5 Mile Creek for Henry Crawford's company, and the day that the shooting was ending, I got a call, and I said yes, and wouldn't tell me what it was. And then said the producer and the two producers will meet with you this evening at the end of the shoot, Cole Kidman and Kevin Dobson, who would be directing her in upcoming episodes, including the next one. And this was kind of like a director-to-director handover dinner, where I naturally sang Nicole's praises to the sky. So that was the purpose of that dinner, and that was fun. And then halfway through, Everett DeRoche and Barbie Taylor came in to another table, and they were the people I was to meet. And then I left Kevin with Nicole and went over and heard that they would like to make a change, would I take over? And I said, yeah, of course, because I'm a great admirer of, and I've made trailers for, scripts. Well, I've made trailers for movies that he wrote. At one point, nearly took over another film that he wrote, Race for the Yankee Zephyr. But that's another story.
Oh, that is. Well, interestingly, Nicole Kidman went on to work with Everett on Wind Rider 3 years later.
Yes, I think, Nicole, you could tell, was going to be a star. And, just wherever she went, whatever she did, she was luminous. The camera loved her, and she was, skillful in interpreting the text, or as actors have to do, faking reality. And she just had she was a natural. She has had the career that I predicted, and it's not over yet.
No, not by a long stretch.
So that's how I first became introduced into the project. So the next day I looked at the footage that was shot and went on and met with Henry, listened to his concerns, showed him BMX Bandits, and in which we got a, you can't do that these days so easily, but we just rang up the local Village Roadshow Theatre said, can we run this first thing in the morning before your session starts? And they said, oh, sure. So Henry got to see BMX Bandits on the widescreen. Then that was the weekend, that was the Saturday, and started shooting the next day, on the Monday, I think it was. I don't know, it was a long time ago, but it was then 36 Fast and Furious days that I loved every minute of, and it was great working with everybody, and there was great sort of esprit de corps. And Barbie Taylor and Everett were, they really wanted to make the best film they possibly could, and they were very smart about it. They had chosen great locations. Everett was very involved in the in the production process. And because so often a writer does not have his script protected creatively after it's been handed over to a producer and a director. But, you know, this was a good team where Barbie wanted Everett's vision on the screen. And so did I. And so I applied myself to that vision, which I was in sync with this kind of 50s ambiance of the country town. So that was great. And the script offered me opportunities to do sequences I enjoy, such as all the BMX stuff, and the spooky meeting with Charlie Pride, and a number of other little set pieces. It was a great experience.
Well, fantastic. You've actually answered a couple of my questions in that, which is fantastic. So I would like to just quickly discuss Everett. By his own admission, you know, this is his most personal film and the only one he ever took a producer's credit on. And I was going to ask you what it was like to work with him, but you answered that. And I was just wondering, it's interesting that the two of you were possibly the most prolific voices in Australian cinema at that time. Did you ever have an opportunity to work later on down the road that just never came to fruition?
Yes. Sadly, a sequel to Conan. Boy, we could have made a great movie out of that. No. But Dina De Laurentiis was thinking of doing something in Australia, and I had proposed, being a Conan fan, that you think about doing a Conan film in a tropical and a beach and reef setting, and I got a certain amount of lip service to that, and in the end, my deal with Dino didn't work out. But Everett had this other idea that had been germinating for a while about, an ecological disaster, whatever, has caused the oceans to rise, and therefore the skyscrapers at Surface Paradise are, half of them are jutting out of the water. And there are these separate skyscraper communities that over the eons have become inhabited totally by women as a refuge. And the population grows through, genetic programming of all babies to be female. So it's a total woman society, which has to defend itself against male pirates. Well, into this idea of Everett, we put Conan, who gets washed up against the skyscraper and taken in by this all-female society, and you can imagine there would be some interesting opportunities for drama and comedy in that scenario. So that was the basic outline of it, and I pitched it, but it fell on stony ground. But it would make a wild movie and still would.
I'm outraged that it didn't get made. I'd love to see that.
Oh, yes. Well, it could have some interesting points to make about tribalism and let's say science out of control.
Absolutely. Well, Everett wrote some very edgy stuff for Frog Dream, especially for a family movie. And you had swearing, you had smoking. There was an element of horror in there. He described it as a kiddie thriller. Were there ever any concerns of how dark it was going? Was there any pressure to tone it down?
No. I've never met a moment of controversy that I didn't like. So I thought, great. Goodness me, today they'd be smoking weed and doing lines or something. But, that's a different kind of Hollywood movie. But did you see, what was that, film 14? A fairly shocking depiction of the teen life in Los Angeles. Anyway, back to Frog Dreaming, and a nicer, gentler period, socially speaking. But smoking the conflict between the sisters, and I like that. And Henry wanted to stretch a bit more with the film, and he wanted a scene where he emotionally let rip. So Everett provided it. The one with Tony Barry when he does, lose it emotionally, and that was a great moment for Henry. Everett had, a good insight into character and into how the way children feel, because he is the father of six children and goodness knows how many grandchildren by now, but he certainly had quite a few grandchildren before he passed on. So he was a great observer of parental-child relationships, and I think he brought his insight to Frog Dreaming and to all the kids' series stuff that he did in the 90s.
Do you think the same film could be made in today's age, like in the context of being a family adventure?
Well, yes, I know. It would not be considered edgy today. I was encouraged to make BMX Bandits edgier in terms of making the cops more threatening and real. And so there was certainly never any pressure to conform to standard sort of conservative children's film values, let's say.
I'm actually also interested to know, of the abandoned footage that was shot before you came along, has any of that survived? Do you think it would ever see the light of day?
I don't think it would, really, because we picked the eyes out of it. And the most sustained piece of it is in that the Rockabilly. That's really the most sustained piece from the original footage.
And the film, of course, around the world has several different titles. You've got The Quest in the USA, Go Kids in the UK, Spirit Chaser in some parts of Europe. Do you have a preferred title yourself?
I like the intriguing original title, Frog Dreaming. And I think as the world gets a little bit more hip, that will become, that's a title where people say, what is that about? They don't have a poster with a giant frog on the front with a man's hand hanging out of it, and totally try and missell the movie. Mm-hmm. And that sort of thing has happened, actually. Not with Frog Dreaming, but with other movies. I think Frog Dreaming is an excellent title because the sort of ecological subtext to the movie, and that helps point an audience that way. Any title that gets bums on seats, I always say.
Well, that's true. I agree with you with the original title. Do you think in retrospect that the original title would have fared well around the world at that time?
Undoubtedly not. But now I think the world is a little bit more ready for the Aboriginal mystical side of the movie and knows just a little bit more perhaps about the native Australians, the first Australians. I think an ad campaign could actually use that as a plus, and it may initially be, I think it's still pleasing to a kid audience today. They accept its old-fashionedness, but they're hooked by Henry. Henry's got great magnetic charm, and so I think it doesn't play as a slow movie necessarily anymore to kids that are into that sort of thing.
So I wanted to talk about some of the technical aspects of the film. You had stuff like tricky stuff like the rail, track, bicycle, and Donkeygen itself. And given the breakneck pace of the production, what was the biggest challenge in pulling that all off?
Every kind of mechanical gag like that or stunt gag, it requires a lot of careful thought and preparation. And I will say this, that a great deal of thought had gone into it prior to my arrival. Which was good. The railway bike was a little bit of a worry because it could come apart quite easily. We had a couple of near spills. So I minimized the amount of time Henry actually spent on it. And we came up with a way of putting him on a low loader securing the bike to some, like a treadmill of drums, of perfectly smooth, round, drums that he, as so he pedaled and pushed hard, and looked like he was biking, he was, the wheels were just sort of going around on the drums, and So a low angle from just below the handlebars, which incorporated the front wheel turning, that gave the lie to the fact that he was actually speeding along. And the trees were, you know, receding on either side of him. And, you know, it really looked like he was certainly, you know, riding along the rails. So we cut that, did that on a long straight road and cut that into the shots of the double riding the actual railway bike, which we speeded up in a couple of areas. And as for the crash, we had to, well, I break things down into a series of shots as they would ultimately edit together. And then you know you've got the coverage that you need. As long as you've got it so that it will stitch together fluidly, then that's the important thing. So those little moments had to be, you know, carefully sort of planned in advance. The mechanical donkagen was quite a feat of engineering, because you have to take into account water weight. So, you know, John Dowding, you know, did a fantastic job, and I've worked with John since. It was, it was a really great effort, and we were able to put Henry in the water as it rose up, and get shots of the real guy with this monster in the same frame. Nowadays, maybe we'd do it with green screen or something, but in those days, seeing had to be believing. And we had a diver in the water, and his mother was there to watch. He did well, and he looked like he was really struggling. And that was great.
Little bit evil.
Yeah. Well, it was a good image, people I think are sufficiently, you know, carried along by the way that, you know, Everett has steered the mythology, they accept both sides of Donkagen, the mystical side and the mechanical side, and the side involving, you know, the physics and the interaction of air and water.
Well, speaking of the mythology of it, the end scene is a very strange, perplexing piece of, I suppose, surrealism, possibly metaphorical. Was that in the script, or was that done on the fly? Was it an afterthought?
It was at the end, and then we came back with photo doubles, and some of the original actors, and picked up new scenes that had been dropped, you know, from the schedule prior to my arrival. Henry had finished his contract, but we made sure we had all the shots we needed of him. And then, you know, the ending was, you know, something that had arisen during production, as I understand it. And it seemed to be that, you know, you've got to have some kind of nice, not a sting in the tail necessarily, but the audience would like to believe that there's a bit of magic in science.
Frog Dreaming and Dead End Driving were released in the same month, I believe. Was there any creative connections between those films?
I don't think that is so.
No?
I don't believe, I mean, if you're talking about Australia.
Okay.
Frog Dreaming was a school holiday picture. Might have been August school holidays or something like that. Dead End Drive-In was thrown away by Greater Union film distributors just before Christmas. In Sydney, it opened in the third screen of a theatre that was still under construction.
Wow.
Anyway, so it was doomed in Australia. But it has, you know, done very well for me, internationally, and it's been recognized for what it is. But Frog Dreaming was similarly, it needed a more aggressive campaign.
Were you involved in any of the marketing?
No, I wasn't, because I was away doing another film. Let me see, what was it? It was 1985. But I did make, I think I made a trailer. No, actually, I didn't, because I was too busy on Dead End Driving. That was one that was made without me. So I did make a lot of the early Australian trailers.
Right.
And that's how I came across Everett's work. First of all, you know, Snapshot and Long Weekend.
I know, interestingly, when you had your interview with Mark Hartley with Quentin Tarantino beside you, he mentioned at the time that Frog Dreaming or The Quest was the only one of your films that he hasn't seen. Do you know if he's watched it since?
I'm quite sure he has seen it because he has a 16mm print in his personal vault, and he put that on at the New Beverly Cinema on Beverly Boulevard in Los Angeles late last year sometime. So I think he has seen it, but he's never seen it on the big screen, and for various bureaucratic reasons, inheritors of the film have been denied access to him. We're looking internationally to see if old Interpos or something like that could be found in a foreign lab. I mean, these things can happen. That's how Wake in Fright was rediscovered and remastered, because there was an aging negative or Interpos or Interneg in some New York laboratory. And from that, they were able to rebuild the film. So I hope the bureaucracy sees sense and allows us access to the original negative materials.
I know that Umbrella is definitely working towards it, so with a bit of luck...
Yeah, I'm working with Umbrella on
this. Oh, fantastic. And I know that Everett's family has a mountain of behind-the-scenes footage that they want to donate for, you know, special additional content and whatnot. So it would be a fantastic release if it happened.
Yeah, no, I think so. And it's a film that, you know, that really nearly stumbled and fell and yet got up and ran. And sometimes out of the worst of luck, the best of luck can come with a movie. Though, speaking personally, it's happened the other way around too. But I just would like it to be seen. And it's a time capsule of Australian rural life in a way that's packaged for an international family audience, and particularly an American family audience. Anyway, there you have it. So is there anything else?
Well, not in regards to Frog Dreaming. I think that pretty much covers it. I would like to direct our listeners to the current Umbrella release, because there's an interview with yourself and Henry as well as Everett that covers a lot of the production that, you know, is definitely worth tapping into and having a listen to. If I could just ask one question, if you don't mind, because this one really is a curiosity for me. I recently, as of last week, finally got to watch your Pimpin' Pee-wee film, which I thought was far better than people have let on. I thought it was actually quite racy. It was far more explicit than any of the previous films. I really hope that one does get a release at some point.
How did you get to see it?
Well, it finally found its way onto YouTube, so the entire film is currently up there. I don't know how long it will last before they pull it down. I guess somebody had recorded it off the brief VOD that was, you know, released, but it's there.
Well, I tell your friends, grab a bit of... It's my first foray, really, into sexploitation.
Well, I can tell you what, it was a lot better than I had been led to believe, and I actually really, really enjoyed it. And the comedy was really on point, which was surprising to me. And to be honest with you, I ripped it off YouTube and put it onto disc, so I've got a copy to keep.
Please, and tell all your friends to do that quickly before it's taken down. I have no financial interest in it.
Sure.
It's one of those curious things that was made to satisfy a contractual requirement.
Yes, of course.
So that the backer could maintain the rights to the original Porky franchise. But it all ended in tears and litigation and whatever. But so the film doesn't have the release it would otherwise have had. It was sort of being held as the first video, direct-to-video, after they had remade the feature as a $12 million film or something.
Sure.
And then they could do the college years as a derivative. Anyway, it all went wrong. But 15 days, that was, quite a challenge. But it was fun. But they're all fun. And if you ever come across the Chemistry series, which has been on Cinemax, which is fairly explicit. It's a sex comedy set in a legal office. But I got to flex my comedy muscles there too. I'm really a comedy director. I can't help making some things funny.
Well, you do a great job at that.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Glenn. Goodbye for now.
Thank you very much, Brian.